Well, hi, everybody, and welcome. Thanks again for your flexibility with our last seminar, and I hope you've had a chance to listen to the recording to be up to date. We're going to talk about an extension of our discussion, particularly looking at peak performance under pressure. I'm going to, because of the emails and the comments that some of you have sent in, and I appreciate that very much. It helps me know what's important to you and what will be most helpful. I'm going to depart somewhat from the outline, still sticking essentially to that, but I'm going to add a couple of things. One, an application of a case study, and another to really look at a work tool that's in your resources, the resource guide and exercises that I think you might find helpful with clients. So as we start, anything to add or ask or comment about before we move to lecture mode and launch into that part of our discussion? Anything at all? Well, again, if there's something that you'd like to clarify, add, ask, or just comment on, or suggest for further discussion, please feel free to email. That's in the email that you've received. So we're in presentation mode now so that you don't have to worry about the background noise. First, let's talk about an optimum performance mindset. And performance is roughly anything that you want to focus on and achieve. And let's think about it first, at least, in terms of your working with clients. And think about, at the same time, how your client is hearing you and engaging with you to look at what that client can do to optimize their effectiveness and their performance. Now, we touched on this just briefly. The physiological response in your body and the activation in your brain to excitement and to fear are exactly the same. Your body and your brain can't tell the difference. The only difference between excitement and fear then becomes the framing, how you frame something that boots up a particular mindset to deal with everything that follows. With a response of fear or anxiety, your mind and brain search for what's wrong, what may be of danger, lights on something that consciously makes sense, and then connects cause and effect. And that association creates closure. Linking this physiological response with a negative meaning then can read as fear. So just before you began with a task or a focus where you have increased activation of alertness, heart racing, sweaty palms, instead of automatically linking it to anxiety or fear, then looking for what caused it or what can go wrong, substitute the framing of, I'm excited, I'm ready. Reframe to ask, why am I ready to do this? This provides a positive framework of anticipatory readiness. Remember, we talked about it in a simpler way initially about framing with the client possibility rather than problem, where the client will, if framing it as a problem, go down the pathway that's all too familiar and etch it further, whereas looking at possibility may not be as easy because that means creating new neuronal networks and a new association. It takes work, and there's a lack of certainty in that, but the excitement of possibility of looking at things in a new way. So performance anxiety can then be an indication of how much you care both about performance and outcome. It's normal, even necessary, to feel anxious as preparation for performing exactly as you want to. Frame the anxiety as the excitement to ally with the anxiety, to channel it into performing well. Consider the anxiety as your mind and body preparing itself to perform, and then execute in a successful way you've practiced. Attention awakens the prefrontal cortex to then insert the current framework and state of mind in this moment, rather than an instant state shift into anxiety and negative thinking. So a key to consistently perform optimally or engage optimally is to effectively enter and sustain that state of mind for what you want to do. Think about it in terms of engaging with the client. Immediately prior to that engagement, to get grounded and centered, to have full focus on the client and on the engagement. If there's anything that distracts you, if you have a thought of, well, I don't really know about that topic, or am I going to ask the right question? Consider that a choke. A choke is any instantaneous movement away from that performance flow, that flow of engagement. So use that as a cue to immediately get refocused on your client. Remember, we used the analogy of a mindfulness meditation, of focusing on your breath, of breathing in relaxation, breathing out any tension. If you have a thought, let it go. Don't engage it. Same here. Whatever the distraction is, don't engage it. Refocus on your task, on listening and engaging with your client in that collaborative endeavor. So when a performer in any endeavor has practiced essentially the same tens of thousands of hours as the next person, outcome is determined more by optimum mental state and effective sustained focus for peak performance. Same is true at the opposite end of new experiences, such as beginning a coaching practice and a coaching framework conversations. Same process to enter that state of mind for full focus and attention. Now, a significant number of studies find the most common psychological characteristics of optimum performance of whatever type, intellectual, sports, any kind of endeavor, confidence with positive expectations about the performance, full concentration with focus on this present task, a strong commitment to sustain that focus, feeling energized yet relaxed, and a mental toughness to sustain that focus even under pressure, even if the client goes somewhere you have no clue what you may be able to do, sustain the focus, and you and the client will be able to continue that discussion. Mastery of all aspects of pressure situations means being aware of emotional triggers, of thoughts, feelings, events that could potentially disrupt focus and state. And that includes extreme success or extreme failure. This is not something we're going to talk about, but something that I think you may want to think about, that when you sustain work with your client, they're going to have a success that may be unprecedented. And think of prototype examples of extreme success, wealth, fame, power, influence. They may not have a model of how to deal with that. And without the mental models and the use of intuition based on past experiences, they're especially going to need you to engage with them to help them develop a way to create a new way of proceeding. So a routine is effective because when it's repeated enough, the brain creates a neuronal pathway and network to make this a default mode, to become automatic without requiring effort. Now, here's an application of that. Studies have shown that athletes who use a pre-performance routine perform better than those who don't. This systematic entry into an optimum performance state of mind ensures access to the software specific for that deliberate practice and execution of the particular skill. A routine can both guide focus and enhance a sense of effectiveness and mastery to execute a best plan of action through a performance. We'll talk about different ways of doing that in a moment, but the simplest example that I've had in recent time, I worked with a pro cornerback, and in football, the performance flow is episodic as opposed to basketball, where it's a continuous flow state. So every time there's a play, a player has to get in state again, and then there's time in between where nothing's happening. So every time the player has to get in state. His simple version of that was to say to himself, reset. And we'll talk about how that can represent an entire mantra, a cue, a focus, a physiology in just a bit. But reset was an instant way of getting in state to perform optimally and re-enter that performance zone. So one thing to think about is how can this be applied? Let me give you a framing example from a mentor coaching client to show you a different kind of application here about how framing can make a difference. A CEO I'm going to call Dan had a tragedy at his company, a serious accident of one of his people, and on-the-job injuries, and a death at one of the operating sites. It was 3 months since this accident and the injuries and death, but he still had stress-related symptoms, losing sleep, depleted energy, preoccupation with safety, and he recognized that his responses hampered his effectiveness as an executive and his ability to provide the leadership that his company needed. And he also recognized how this was having an influence on his people, that production had waned, and the various measures showed that the company had a systemic effect, that they were not performing as well. So I asked Dan, what went through his mind the moment he woke up? His answer was, well, you know, it's been since the accident for 3 months. What could go wrong today? Is there going to be another accident? And he described questions about what he could do for his company, how he felt helpless at times, what he could do to reassure the group about there being no more accidents, how he could mitigate any potential future danger. So his thoughts focused on avoiding something negative. So he recognized the mindset he began each day for the 3 months now since the event had been essentially the same. He had set the tone both for himself and his corporation. His concern had permeated not just his executive team, but somehow trickled down to each employee. He knew he had to do something different, but he wasn't quite sure what to do when we began work. Nothing had seemed to work for very long. So this is going to sound way too simple for you guys. We began with a very simple approach. I had already asked him what he thought about first thing when he woke up before he ever turned on his bedside lamp, and he told me the things that could go wrong, how to avoid danger, how to, you know, mitigate what could happen. I suggested he try something different. And I explained to him, we're always asking ourselves questions, whether we're conscious of them or not, from the moment we wake up. And he had been very aware of those negative questions. This internal conversation sets in motion a mindset to initiate the day to build on. So his inner dialogue, much of it unconscious, but some of it painfully not so, at stressful times included, what's going to happen today? Will I be able to handle it? What am I really afraid of? I suggested sometime during the day or the evening, before he went to bed, that he write down three questions that would put him in an empowered, positive state of mind. Questions that would focus on his effectiveness or what he could do rather than what he had felt helpless to do. That would instantly boot up a state of mind of confidence and mastery. Questions that might include what would be empowering, a positive mindset, powerful, accomplished, unstoppable, whatever that would be for him. And then, as soon as he woke up, to answer those three questions each morning before he ever got out of bed. The next week at our session, he immediately reported the difference these questions had made. He recognized he had previously begun each day with negative self-talk. That had booted up a mindset that prevailed through much of the morning, often much of the day. And with that mindset, he recognized how contagious it was in his organization. He knew it was not what had created his and the organization's successes. By shifting consciously to positive self-talk, he booted up a positive mindset that then built on itself throughout the day. Then we could extend that by looking at how to reestablish that mindset when various things would happen in the day to get him derailed. Now, this sounds all too simple. This initial reframing of his self-narrative to direct his power of focus to launch a positive state of mind to engage the day became a model that he passed on, just as he had in other leadership models and experiences, directly and indirectly to his organization. He noticed within days the impact it had on his executive team and how this change trickled down through his organization. So this is the challenge of peak performance, to enter an optimum mindset for the task and to sustain that mindset for the entire performance flow. And this, for him, became simply a self-awareness and a self-talk that informed an internal dialogue so that he could reestablish that confidence and create affirmations for himself that directly enhanced his performance. And as he did it for others, it affected their performance as well. Remember, we get what we focus on. The unconscious does not know the difference between positive or negative, just the focus. A positive self-talk in the present moment immediately replaces negative focus. So it's important to recognize that a different set of strategies, including self-talk and affirmations, may be needed in different performance arenas. In athletics, a runner may need a focus phrase of powerful and steady, or keep your pace during races. I've worked with golfers, for example, who need a different focus phrase when they need to do a powerful booming drive versus a middle game when they need to be relaxed and specifically accurate from putting when they need to focus on being relaxed and smooth. So these ways of customizing how someone can frame this, self-talk can enhance resilience and facilitate rebound from failure. And this has been shown in a number of ways about how effective this can be and how effective it can be in performing under pressure. Let me give you a very simple illustration of this. What do you think the effect on performance is of playing to win versus playing not to lose? Two different frameworks. They're subtle, but they're very real. Here's an illustration. One's a positive framework. One is a negative framework that you want to avoid. Here's the simplest study that I've seen, actually, that addresses that. For a soccer penalty kick, everyone is the same 12 yards away. It's a 72-square-foot target guarded by one goalie. When playing to win, in other words, when making the goal will result in a win, this is the end of the game, it's tied. If the penalty kick goes in, the team wins. Kickers are successful 92% of the time. If the framing is differently, if the team is down by one and the kicker has to make it in order to tie, in other words, they're playing not to lose rather than playing to win, if you miss it, your team will lose, success rate is 62%. A 32% difference just based on how it's framed. Same distance, same target, two different mindsets. 30% difference in success rate. Now, in the threat mindset, playing not to lose, expectations are high, but there's also a kind of feeling of judgment. You can't make a single mistake. You play not to lose. The result may be more anxiety, booting up an entirely different mindset from the playing to win mindset. Playing to win is based more on confidence. Playing not to lose based more on fear. Playing to win optimizes performance. Playing not to lose is defensive. It can result in a lesser performance. Playing to win is thriving and superiority. Playing not to lose is surviving and mediocre often. Playing to win creates optimum experience. Playing not to lose creates stressful experience. And finally, playing to win often enhances abilities. Playing not to lose compromises expression of abilities. So this has to do with how things are viewed and framed. So here, amid this is back to the outline. Three simple definitions that I want to discuss a little bit more, especially in terms of resilience. Stress is generated in any situation with too many demands and too few resources to meet the demands, such as energy, time, or money. Pressure results from the significance we give a situation, the expectations we place on our performance, and our stake as we see it in the outcome. The third, after stress and pressure, state of mind. It's a mind-body state, like a specific software program that determines both how we receive and how we perceive and process information and how we respond. State of mind is a set of particular emotions, memories, mental models, and behavioral patterns that are developed in deliberate practice. It is its own software. So success most often has to do with how we manage our internal state under pressure-inducing circumstances. Those who develop pressure management strategies, and this is what we help our clients do, create a more optimum performance. Without these strategies and pressure situations, focus can become concentrated and narrow to result in a range from mental rigidity to impulsivity. So let's look at how to develop resilience in performance, whatever that performance is, intellectual, the arts, business, coaching. Here's from Dean Becker, a quote. Not sure if this is in your outline, which is why I'm saying it. More than education, more than experience, more than training, a person's level of resilience will determine who succeeds and who fails. That's true in the cancer ward. It's true in the Olympics. It's true in the boardroom. Here's an illustration of that. This is in honor of the Boston Marathon, which occurred today. My daughter and I have participated in that in years past. Theo Epstein guided the Boston Red Sox to their first World Series victory in 86 years. Then He later agreed in 2011 to lead the Chicago Cubs, whose last World Series championship was in 1908. The Cubs then won in 2016, 108 years later. Epstein was widely touted as having an innate and rare intelligence to deconstruct a situation to its simplest form, to generate strategic possibilities. He was asked how he decides what he looks for in putting together a team. He indicated that he scouts the person more than the player. Epstein said that the first thing he wants to know about any potential player is how he's handled adversity. Resilience grows by converting mistakes into lessons. By reflecting on and learning from mistakes, we convert a regrettable experience into a learning experience, a growth mindset. Resilience is the ability to modulate and constructively harness any stress response. That's essential to both physical and mental health. Success in any arena hinges on resilience. Management of setbacks, for example, to productively progress becomes an essential process of optimal performance. Persistence toward a goal in the face of challenges characterizes success for athletes to executives. A resilient individual is not someone who avoids stress, but someone who learns how to effectively manage it and optimize performance while doing so. Now, a micro lesson here. Every time you work with a client in each session, when they are ready to take a step into the new, the different, the previously unexperienced, they will need to proceed despite anxiety, uncertainty, trepidation before they can experience mastery. If they stop themselves and move back to something they're familiar with, they will establish all kind of reasons that makes it make sense, and everything in the time capsule of the negative self-talk, all the reasons that they can't do it, those are all the result of stopping themselves. So a resilient individual is not someone who avoids stress, but someone who learns how to effectively master it and optimize their performance. Studies show someone can boost resilience by these four strategies. Reinterpreting negative events. That's reframing that we're talking about now. Enhancing positive emotions. Remember the questions to my CEO. What can you think about or focus on that will put you in an empowered state, a very positive state of mind? Third, what we know from research, becoming physically fit. And fourth, maintaining a supportive social network to help that resilience and have role models and feedback. The ability to regulate states of mind and manage emotions is central to establishing resilience. This is one of the things that we inevitably help our clients with, is to regulate states of mind and manage emotions in order to sustain focus and as part of it. Two approaches demonstrated in recent research to regulate states of mind and enhance resilience are cognitive reappraisal and mindfulness meditation. Let me just say a couple of words about each. Cognitive reappraisal is simply reframing from a negative to a positive, a fancy term, but it's just a reframing from problem to possibility in order to reinterpret the meaning of any event, to see it as a challenge, as an opportunity to not go down the old pathway of explaining the problem. A Mount Sinai School of Medicine study of Vietnam prisoners of war found that those who had actively reappraised their imprisonment to find meaningful ways in which to grow stronger and more resilient showed the most adaptive responses. Mindfulness meditation we've already used as a metaphor. It focuses on how to get grounded and centered in the present moment rather than dwelling in the past. or being uncertain or fretting about the future, or engaging in negative rumination. It's a focus on now and present experience. It's also been associated with improved ability to focus, increased flexibility of thinking, and greater psychological well-being. This is why it's such a terrific metaphor for the model that we use in a collaborative alliance with our clients, to stay focused with the client, to looking at possibility of possible approaches that can be engaging, empowering, successful. Both cognitive reappraisal and mindfulness meditation have been shown to increase the activation of the left prefrontal cortex. That's the brain area associated with greater emotional control, boosting positive emotions, and faster recovery from uncomfortable feeling. So I want to go to the neuroconditioning chart that you have in your in the resources. I don't have the exact page number, but look for the neuroconditioning chart. And I'd like to walk through that with you to look at how to develop that, maybe how to use it as a model to work on in your own time. Here's a backstory for that chart and one study that I used in constructing that. It's kind of a microsystem of self-regulation and focus. Here's the backstory. When Southern Utah University's new basketball coach, Robert Reed, arrived, his team ranked 217th in free throw percentage, lowest in their division nationwide. During practice, Reed had his players develop a mantra before each free shot. It was a one or two or three word phrase accompanied by a deep breath for relaxation. And the cue was to dribble the basketball twice. So the cue to initiate this, dribbling twice, a deep breath to breathe in relaxation, and a phrase to focus their attention, such as relaxed and smooth, but he emphasized each player do their own. Now, additionally, during practice, he would suddenly blow the whistle, player went to the line to shoot two free throws. If they made both, they got a break. If they did, four laps. So he simulated game conditioned with a bit of pressure. In 2 years, his team was number one in their division nationwide in free shot percentage. So the neural conditioning program offers a systematic way to rewire optimum performance behavior. So this cue, look at the neural conditioning under the old story. And here's what I'd suggest that you do. Schedule a time, an appointment with yourself without any interruption, and focus just on this first column of looking at what kind of things are emotional triggers for you, something that will disrupt you, upset you, set some negative response or negative self-talk in motion. Write down every emotional trigger that you can think of. And beside it, in the second column, the usual response or behavior, what is your usual response in for that trigger specifically? What kind of behavior? Is it negative self-talk? Is it anxiety? Is it some kind of disruption? What will that trigger set off? And look at the specific response for each of those triggers. And do this as an observer, not getting triggered in the process, but look at it as an observer, that you're coaching yourself. You're looking at usual things that may trigger or upset you or get you derailed or deflected, and What is it that is your response? What thoughts or feelings or behavior is a result of that? Now, that thin line between column one and column two is a state change. Whenever there's something that disrupts your state, an emotional trigger, that's state changing. Everything in column two, usual behavior response, that's a time capsule. Think about how those responses or behaviors or feelings probably haven't changed in your adult life. That time capsule remains the same. I asked one woman who I first hatched this idea of doing it with to look at her emotional triggers, and I asked her, what's the age of this conversation? And she immediately said 13 or 14. It's like I'm back there all over again when I'm triggered, when I'm with my family. So she knew immediately when that occurred. Now, a different time, maybe a day or two later, come back to this same neuroconditioning chart and develop a mantra. And this can be the same mantra for every one of these emotional triggers. The cue, the focus, the physiology. The cue, remember, in the illustration I just gave was bouncing a basketball twice. And a focus phrase that aligned the energy field of the brain. And a deep breath for relaxation. That can be done in 2 or 3 seconds. You might think about a gesture that will immediately get you grounded and centered. I came up with a new one for me. This last weekend, I was honored to do the eulogy of my favorite sports coach, who had been like a second dad to me, and I wanted to get through the entire presentation without getting misty or doing anything that would disrupt the focus each person listening to me would have on my coach. So what I did was simply find a specific cue that I could do without anybody seeing it. I moved my thumb into a sharp pressure point of my index finger, and that instantly got me in state whenever I was even in any way beginning to get a little misty about something I was saying, because the things I was saying were moving to me, but I wanted to let everyone have their own reaction, not react to me. It worked great. It was a simple, instant gesture that was grounding and centering. So, in the third and fourth column, develop your own mantra, a cue, a focus, a physiology. And the woman I mentioned, what she used as a cue was to touch her ring. And every time she began to even have an interaction with family members that would seem disruptive or to derail her, she would touch her ring, say a focus phrase, and do a deep breath. And I emphasized that in the beginning, this is not going to be easy, it's not going to be instant, that she may need to call a timeout and, you know, take a walk or go to the bathroom or go to a different room or just move from the family dining table. And have pre-planned an ideal response. What ideally would she like to do or say or feel or think in that particular instant? And it inevitably was to indicate something that would continue the conversation with the family member who otherwise would have been disruptive and she would have been, you know, upset for the remainder of the time. So the mantra quickly was a cue, a focus, a physiology. The ideal behavior was pre-planned. Now, when she came back from that holiday, she indicated it was the best family holiday she'd ever had, that she had a struggle at times, but she had a way to systematically deal with it. And I emphasized to her that it would take practice and continuation of that, and it will become automatic. So what this does, and the reason I'm referring to it as neural conditioning, this rewires your brain. Whenever there's an emotional trigger, instead of instantly having it boot up a state of mind that's already well established, the dialogue, the feelings, the behavior are already there, have been there for a long, long time, to instead get grounded and centered and engage in new behavior. So that ultimately what was an emotional trigger will only be a cue for that revised behavior. Now, it takes time, but the brain can rewire, and it can rewire in an instance like this. So as you look at this four-column process, the focus on the emotional trigger and the usual response, columns 1 and 2, allow you to immediately recognize that cue, that emotionally based cue, and the resultant change in behavior, in feeling, usually in action. So to cue your radar to recognize the trigger and response as quickly as possible allows you to see the process of that state change rather than staying stuck in that column 2, stuck in the content of that altered state. Like a time capsule, that content, column 2, will not change. It will always be intact, but you don't have to inhabit that state. You recognize it as quickly as possible in order to get grounded and centered, then move to that ideal state of column 4. Have the mantra ready. Have it practiced so that you can immediately engage it to move to that pre-planned behavior. So moving horizontally across all four columns requires focus and systematic attention. You may not want to do it in this way or use this kind of tool with a client, but it's the principle here that's important. As you do this repeatedly, you'll notice that a repetition of regulating and self-regulating a mood, a state, especially an emotional trigger, will become a little bit easier all along. It takes time to rewire a brain, but this neural conditioning ultimately rewires using that automatic cue to induce that grounded state. The key here is column 3, to be able to get grounded and centered as soon as you recognize any state change or even beginning of state change. Then as you repeatedly move through all four steps to the ideal response or behavior, this will rewire your brain to couple the emotional trigger, the original trigger, with a now ideal response that's pre-planned and you're just engaging in it. With consistent repetition of this new sequence, the emotional trigger that previously resulted in an instantaneous state change rewires the brain for an automatic ideal response. Now, let's revisit the idea of deliberate practice. We talked about it just a bit last time. Let me pose a question. Are you getting better at the things you most care about? Or are you not improving enough at things that matter to you, despite spending a lot of time working hard at them? Let me tell you a story. Angela Duckworth, one of my favorite authors, who authored, among other things, Grit, which I think is a terrific book for coaches. Dr. Duckworth consulted with Professor Anders Ericsson, the founder of deliberate practice and the initiator of peak performance principles in psychology. She consulted with Erickson, saying that she'd been jogging an hour a day, several days a week, since she was 18 years old. She was almost 50 at this time, but had not gotten better in all of that time. Thousands of hours, she was doing the same thing repeatedly and just couldn't see any progress. So she consulted the godfather of peak performance, Anders Ericsson. So Dr. Erison, who had spent a professional lifetime studying the elements of experts as they become experts and researching the art and science of how someone practices to become expert and what they do to perform exceptionally, he asked Duckworth these four or five questions. Do you have a specific goal for your training? Before you go for a run, do you have a target in terms of the pace you'd like to keep? Do you have a distance goal for each run? Is there a specific aspect of your running you try to improve each time? Do you have a coach? After she answered each question with a no, his conclusion, I think I understand. You aren't improving because you're not practicing right. Anders Ericsson became curious in the 1990s how people became experts at what they did. The prevailing wisdom at that time was that the right DNA and an accumulation of experience resulted in expertise. He found research from a number of fields that had a common finding. Here are some examples. Physics professors at University of California, Berkeley, failed to outperform students on introductory problem sets, even though the professors had been researching and teaching physics, some for decades. The number of years clinical psychologists had practiced had no correlation with success at treating patients. I know I'm revisiting a little bit of this from a previous discussion. Many physicians actually got worse at making diagnoses as they gained more experience. And experienced wine tasters didn't do as well as rookies. What he found with his team of researchers beginning in Berlin to study violinists at the famous Global Music Academy, many of the world's best violinists were trained there. All the candidates were pre-selected as the best in the world. Nearly everyone practiced the same amount of time every week. So he looked at a comprehensive number of factors. What he found was that those who improved, engaged in deliberate practice, in a growth mindset of addressing each of those five questions that he asked Angela Duckworth. And what he found from that is practice does not make perfect. In fact, practice itself can make you worse. Every shot that misses its mark is making your aim worse. This is the neuroscience of deliberate practice. Repetition of specific intended motor skill rewires so that each time over and over, it becomes faster, easier, smoother. Think about your clients who talk about how they're doing the same thing and how they re-engage with a negative mindset or practice or talking about the problems and why those problems exist instead of focusing with you in an intentional way on now and next that's different and how when you successfully and collaboratively engage that, how that you can make a significant difference for your client. Five questions for each performance goal. Whatever that performance is your goal specific? Is it measurable? Is it positive? Is it inspiring to you? And is it displayed? In other words, an example of that is a client who says, well, you know, I'm really not getting what I want. I feel stuck. I feel absolutely stuck and very frustrated about that. One approach to that might be to ask the client, what would we see that would indicate to both of us that that's the goal that you want? In other words, is there a putting it into action? And if so, what is that action? Because the client's already saying, it's not working. So a consideration for that is to just look at how you can apply this to working with a client. Now, I want to talk about a couple of performance anxiety management things that I think might be helpful for you to consider. And remember, performance can depend on whether you interpret anxiety or excitement for a situation. A worried thought, fear of failure, can boot up a mindset to avoid pain and play not to lose. Consider recognizing any of these as an error message from your brain in order to instantly reframe on a positive mindset and refocus. These are the three simple steps of self-directed neuroplasticity. Recognize an error message from your brain, reframe to a positive mindset, and refocus on the next step, a positive goal, and refocus on the next step. So let's consider four of the most common success completion issues: choking, sandbagging, self-handicapping, and burning out, and how to prevent each. And the answer is going to be very common and very simple about how to prevent each. Now, here's a prelude to choking. Jackie Robinson grabbed his throat in a game between St. Louis and the Dodgers when umpire Bill Stewart badly missed a call. Stewart threw him out of the game. Choking became a common term for just blowing it. Choking usually refers to not executing a specific skill under pressure that you would most likely execute under normal conditions. Here's an example of that. I was working with an Olympic athlete just before the Olympics, and she was having difficulty because something was disrupting her usual flawless routine. I asked her to take us through, step by step, what she did immediately prior to her performance when she noticed some disruption. She went through it frame by frame, and then she mentioned that just for a second she would glance at her biggest competitor to look at what she was doing. And she recognized it as she said it, that this disrupted her performance flow and mindset. So we looked at revising that so she would stay focused, stay immersed in the performance mindset that was very practiced, and she was very successful when she did that. So the best answer is to prevent that, to stay focused and attuned. Now, two particular behaviors can increase pressure and compromise the ability to perform under pressure. One is framing a situation as a unique experience. This is my biggest game. There'll never be an opportunity like this. Today I make history. Thinking of a pressure moment as a single shot heightens the sense of risk and loss. With athletes, for example, loss aversion creates a behavior of playing not to lose instead of playing to win. In an American League Baseball championship, the starting was at the time, this was before the cheating scandal, an Astros fan. Charlie Martin, the Astros pitcher, in Game 3, pivotal game against the Yankees, he was interviewed before the game. He said, "This is the biggest game of my life." And my response at the time was, "Oh, no. The Yankees got 6 runs in the first 2 innings." So this is how right my grandmother was. If you're not having fun, you're not doing it right. The second thing is to exaggerate the situation, to become too attached to the outcome. And this intensifies perhaps fear or anxiety, and any kind of distress, any momentary anxiety can shift the state so that there's a disruption of that practice and performance flow. Another, self-handicaps. Here's what that means. Dr. Eddie O'Connor recognized his process of self-handicapping as a runner. He recognized in not reaching his goal, in the half mile of 210, that he was holding back to have something left at the end of each race, coupled with the hope that he could get there the next time just by trying harder. So he was holding on to hope that compromised even slightly at that elite level his actual performance. He recognized that preserving the hope of doing better was actually interfering with doing better. So self-handicaps, performance barriers, are created to protect someone's sense of self-esteem and confidence. The remedy for self-handicaps, self-reflection, awareness of this process, and focus on the positive goal. Another is sandbagging. This simply refers to attempts to demonstrate in some way a limitation or negative aspect to diminish others' expectations. You've seen this with coaches, to downplay their team and this big game. Sandbagging is designed to diminish the pressure of performance anxiety. But in one study, sandbaggers who predicted lesser performance actually made it a self-fulfilling prophecy. This has been replicated in a number of studies. You know, I may have lost, but it really doesn't count because I didn't try. So a specific remedy for sandbagging, change self-talk. Burnout is another where this is a management of expectation, reframing for success, successful achievement. This is exactly what we do in our coaching work with clients. Now, I want to emphasize here that the discussion that we talked about of the neural condition chart is something I would encourage you to set aside just a bit of time and try it. Before you even begin to think about it with a client, try it to see if there's something specifically that you have or some specific things that are emotional triggers that would disrupt or derail you in some way that would be compromising. And then to be aware of how you can focus on your own mantra, the cue, the focus, the physiology. Anytime you even begin to get a hint of any disruption or any signal of anxiety, and that can, paradoxically it may seem, be doing something new and different, especially that you haven't done it before. You will see this with every client you deal with. Every time they take a step into the new, the different, the unprecedented, something they've not done before, it will be attendant with some form of trepidation or uncertainty, maybe even anxiety, and they're likely to stop themselves and revert to something they're familiar with because familiarity can masquerade as effectiveness. So this is the choice architecture of that instant, that moment with the client, to look at how they can reframe that experience, what they can do to take another step and to engage that in a positive way so that they can get accustomed to the uncertainty, the anxiety. It may even require an empathic comment about, you know, I understand or I hear how this is new and different and maybe a bit uncomfortable in the beginning. Think about when you decided to make your recommendation for your professional coaching services, to indicate your professional fee and what would be involved to do that. That may have been different. For those of you who have not set and collected professional fees, think about how different that was. To make a recommendation to move to that application, initially it may have taken scripting your recommendation to make it clear, brief, simple, specific. And until you became accustomed to that. That was the challenge. Reflect on that experience every time you hear a client doing something new and different and unfamiliar. Listen for the limiting assumption. Well, I need to have more experience to do this, or I need to feel confident before I move in, or I need to have a website before I can really do this. Listen for any limiting assumptions, resonate with the experience, and help your client just as you did to take the next step. So I see we're out of time. I'd hope to allow some time. If there are any questions or clarifications, feel free to email me, and I promise to address it in the discussion next time or to work it into the comments of our final seminar next time. Anything also that you feel you'd like to hear a little bit more about or like to develop further or wrap into the discussion next time, feel free to email me. I welcome. Thank you very much, and again, thanks for your flexibility for last time. I look forward to picking up with you right here next time for our final seminar. Bye now.